Hi, I'm Father Alex. I'm the host of the Godcast. I'm also the vicar of St. Matthew's Church in Burnley, and I'm also the author of Our Daily Bread, from Argos to the Altar, a pre-story, a book that's been recently published by Harper North. It's available in Waterstones bookshops and online at Amazon and any other good booksellers. It's a really good book. Go and check it out. Today on the Godcast, sporting royalty, John Lowe, MBE, three times world darts champion, who was awarded the MBE for his services to his sport and to charity. And actually, John was the first person to have a nine-dart finish televised on the television. So it's fabulous to get him on the Godcast. I really hope you enjoy this interview now. If you do, then please subscribe down in the bottom right-hand corner. Which way is it? Not too sure. But please do subscribe. But for now, enjoy this interview with John Lowe, MBE. Well, John Lowe, it's a real privilege to get you on the Godcast today. How are you?
I'm fine, actually. Very fine. Apart from the weather, which is a bit very rainy at the moment here.
Yeah. Where is home, John? Where did you retire to, or is it somewhere you've lived for many years?
I live in Walton in Chesterfield, but I was only born 4 miles away. I've never moved within the sort of community area of where I live, yeah.
Yeah. I read that you were a Sunderland fan, so how did that come about, that a guy from Chesterfield becomes a Macam?
Well, a lot of people ask me that because on the exhibition circuit, I worked with Federation Brewery for 15 years doing shows, and they're based in Gateshead. And the chairman was obviously absolutely mad Macam at the old Roca Park. And he used to take me on a Saturday to the match, and I came friend of his, Ian Porterfield, and actually Georgie Best, who lived with Porterfield for a while. And, yeah. And ever since then, I've never jumped ship. I am a Chesterfield supporter, but Sunderland in the Premier League.
Yeah, fabulous. That's an interesting story, yeah. So, John, when you agreed to come on the Godcast, you share with me about something that people may be surprised to hear, but you actually come from a religious upbringing, is that right?
I am, and it's very, very religious in a way. It was the sort of religion where you couldn't spend any money on a Sunday. Everything was, you couldn't catch a bus on a Sunday, you had to walk. And we had to walk to the church every Sunday morning, which was 4 miles away. And then we had to go again for the Sunday school in the afternoon, and then go back again at night. And this went on probably four times out of seven. It went on for many years.
Yeah, and was this Church of England we're talking about? Was this the Methodist Church? What was it?
No, it was Pentecostal, which has probably changed its name a little now. But it's where my father all his life gave 10% of his earnings to the church.
Yeah, and was it something you enjoyed? Did you fight back against it at any point, or?
I didn't, because it was an upbringing, It was a bit strange when you look through the window on a Sunday morning, you could see the kids playing around, football and whatever, and I wasn't allowed to do it. And I couldn't figure that bit out for years. But yeah. Now, after many, many years, I realised it was a good upbringing, a really good upbringing.
Did you carry that throughout your life? Is it something that's kind of stayed with you, John?
Yes, it has. Although I obviously varied a lot, like from when I was like 20-year-old, I started racing motorcycles. But I didn't really play darts at all until I was 22. Never threw a dart. You know, so that one day, I was a joiner by trade. But you never forget once you're brought up in that. You can either go against it or not. And I think I'm pleased I never did.
So the school days were you were kind of a more practical person than an academic person. Is that what led you into being a joiner?
It probably was. I had an accident when I was young and missed a year and a half of school, and I never caught that back up. I was more not academic in any ways. It's only since I've travelled the whole world playing darts that I've become more of a knowledgeable person than what I was before.
Yeah, and did you have an interest in darts? We talked about footy a minute ago. Was darts on the kind of the spectrum in any way?
No, none at all. It was only when I was going to Oulton Park to a race meeting, to actually race, that snow, it was called off. It was such a bad day. And I went back home, and we called into a pub on the way. And someone said to me, they were playing darts, and he went to the toilet. He said, would you take my throw? I said, I don't play. But I got hooked on it there and then, and I tried to figure out how to make the darts work without any effort, which I think I worked out in the end, but after all them years of playing, I'm still learning.
Was it something that came natural? I mean, I have a dartboard in my dining room area, and I play quite regularly, but I don't seem to get any better, John. You know, was it a natural flair that you picked up quite quickly?
No, it was something that I learned. Again, I sort of a bit technical. I learned to stand right, how to line up right, how to keep the dart under the eye level and not above it. All them sort of things, you know, which I've written into books and which is quite nice for other people. And I became known as the guy with the, well, if I was at golf, it could be the Harry Vardon grip, that type of thing. And so it became the John Roll throw, which I'm pleased about. And that's why I'm still playing, as old as I am.
Yeah. And can you remember the first competition you entered, or maybe the first competition you won? Can you remember that?
I can, because we played a local league. And in local league, I played for a team that was so good, nobody in the local area could beat them, which I didn't particularly like. I left them because it wasn't an actual competitive game. But in them days, you only won a Japanese alarm clock or a set tea service or something like that. You didn't win anything big. And then the big time came when I won the British Open. That was on TV, and then it snowballed from there, and the joinery became a thing of the past, because I was being asked to visit clubs in Wales and Scotland, and then it jumped Australia and Japan, and I thought the bubble would burst after a few years, but now it's a major sport.
What do you think makes the difference between a top end pro like you became? And the also runs, you know, I don't mean to say that disrespectfully, but is it mental? Is it just practice? What would you attribute it to, John?
I think in my case, hard work. I think you still got to, even if you are slightly 50% natural, I still think you've got to put a lot of hard work in to get to the end of it. But with over 56 million players, you still need them people below to make the game. And so they'll always be aiming for an higher level. And when you get to that higher level, it's more difficult to stay there than come up. It's dead easy to go back down.
Yeah. You must be very proud, John, of your contribution to where darts is now. I mean, I remember I used to love watching the darts as a young guy, and it came round, and the players were personalities, and, you know, the likes of yourself and Eric and Jockey Wilson and Keith Dell, all those kind of players. Did you ever anticipate that it would become as big as it is now?
I didn't. It's a real. We did have to actually break away from the organisation that was set in its own sort of. They didn't have a future plan, and so we had to go with a business company like Barry M to take over from Matchroom, the snooker, and he turned it into a real business where. It's more than just the players. You need spectators, and you need the people to follow, and you also need something that they can say, I like that. And it's fast. If it's boring, you're not bored for very long because it's quick.
And what's your kind of, when I remember those finals that you played in with Eric, it was almost like the classic showdown, wasn't it? Because, you know, I kind of really put it in the same level as, like, you know, Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier and all the great kind of finals, the Dennis Taylor and Steve Davis in the snook. You two were chalk and cheese, weren't you? You really were.
We was. It was the Cockney versus the Northerner, really. And that worked well for newspapers. They loved that. But what people don't realise, for 27 years, one of us got to the final of the World Championship. And then they all thought through newspapers that we argued, we didn't like each other. We played for pairs in the World Cup all over the world together. And then we went on holiday to Tenerife when it all finished. Yep, sadly I miss Eric, but he left us 6 years ago, which was sad because he was a great character.
I was interested to know. I mean, I do like a bit of the psychological stuff, John. But you know, when you're going into, you know, all's fair in love and war, and like you said, you were friends outside of the arena. But when you're going into battle in that moment, what are you thinking psychologically? Is it just keep my calm, play my same game, don't be influenced by the noise that's going on out there? What's your mentality before a big game?
I think both me and Eric were very similar in that sense. He thought he was the best player ever. And I used to stand behind him thinking, no, I'm better than you. And I think you've got to have that, you know, to get there. And believe it or not, there was only two different results after 30-odd years between us.
Yeah.
I'll not tell you who was in front.
And the rewards there, John. I mean, I read that you were the first person to have a 9-dart finish, which I actually watched on YouTube earlier, to have a 9-dart finished, and there was a huge reward for that, wasn't there? Was that life changing for you?
It really was, in a way. I mean, it was in 1984, and people that are superstitious, it was actually on the 13th of October, so it's the 13th for me. It's been quite a good number, and it was the MFI World Match Play. I was playing Keith Deller, and the 9-dart game came, and it was £102,000, which in 1984 was a lot of money. But I didn't rush out and buy a car or anything like that. I actually put it away in a pension fund and said, one day that's going to be okay.
Yeah. And did the endorsements, did they come quite quickly after that?
That's another one. I'm basically a pretty loyal person, and I've been with Unicorn Darts, Unicorn Products, who make the darts, and Gun and More Cricket, they're the same company. I've been with them 50 years next year, which is like probably the longest sponsorship in British sport.
Yeah, yeah. That's really fascinating. I suppose it must have been the perfect relationship, really.
It was, and funnily enough, the owners of that company are called Lowy, L-O-W-Y, whereas I'm Low. So they used to say, are you doing Lowy? You know, both sides. There's others as well. I was the British Car Auctions. They came in and sponsored me for cars for 15 years, which was valuable. I mean, to have a car going around the country doing 50,000 miles a year.
Yeah.
Having your own, you just saw it depreciate that fast. You know, and Citizen Watch of Japan sponsored me for 4 years as well. Good sponsorship, all of them.
Yeah, and you won three world titles, John. I was wondering how they were different. You know, I mean, the first one obviously is kind of the one you chase, but you won one in each decade. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah, and so there was a gap. It wasn't just like a natural flow. Were they different? Did they have different meanings, different significant for you as a person?
They did, but the gap, I actually lost in five world championships. So I was in the final eight times, and I only won three. And they happened to be in three separate decades, 70s, 80s, 90s. But the first world championship ever was against Leighton Rees, the Welsh player, and he beat me. And the following year, the final was me and Leighton Rees, and I beat him. So that was very significant to win the first one. To win the second one means you're not lucky. I always think that. If you win once, people say, oh, you were lucky. And at the end of the day, the draw is all important because there may be better players that have been knocked out. And nobody ever thinks about that. If they're in the opposite end of the draw, you may just be lucky enough to have missed them.
Yeah.
So there is a bit of luck involved as well.
Yeah, and the third one was that kind of... That really cemented your kind of, you know, your legacy in the game.
The second one, I beat Eric. Of course, that will always stand out. Everybody has been, that's the best one, because he was at the top of his game then. I'd been number one for about 5 years, and Eric was number one for 5 years. So it was the perfect game. And then the third one was against Alan Warren from Lancashire. And that did cement it, because then they gave me the trophy. When you win it three times, then you get the trophy, which is one of the only ones I have on display.
Yeah. And I wonder, John, you know, when in those moments of nostalgia, I don't know if you pour yourself a fine wine or a single malt or something. Do you reflect on the ones that you won more than the ones that you didn't win? You know, do you kind of sometimes drift back to those finals and think, if only, or, you know?
Yeah, I do. I played Eric Moore and I was winning 3-0. And I was really got a bad cold. I was terrible. And I got worse and worse, health-wise. And I knew that that was the one I should have won. And on TV, Eric stood there and said, that wasn't the John I know. And I was ill. I shouldn't have played it, really. But you can't call a final off. You've got to turn up and do it. And then afterwards, buy a bottle of champagne or something.
Yeah, you strike me as a very modest man, John. You know, and you said when you won that money for the 9-dart finish, you didn't go out and flash motor. You know, do you think that humility was part of the upbringing that you had?
I do, but I must be honest. I did have a very nice car at that time, so I didn't need one. I got a Lotus Esprit at that time.
Okay, all right.
But when I pulled into the garage the next day, there's a guy putting petrol in his car. And he turned around and he said, hey, great on TV yesterday. He said, I see it's not taking you long to spend the money. And I didn't say anything. As if no. I'd been in the garage here and then I bought a car.
Yeah. You know. And what about the fame side of the sport, John? You know, you are, you know, your name is synonymous with darts. And even like, I was just telling my kids are a lot younger than us both. And, I've heard of that name. I've heard of that name. And, you know, how did you manage the fame side of it? Were you comfortable with it? You like the attention?
I was comfortable with it, but I've probably been more in awe of other people. You know, when I've met the likes of Muhammad Ali, who I've met a couple of times, I was in awe of him because he was my hero in sport. He was, for me, the greatest sportsman of all time at that time. You know, and so I was more... I always felt there's somebody better than you. That's what I always thought.
Yeah. So how did that encounter come about? How did you get to meet him?
I was invited to BBC one Sunday. And they said, would you like to come and meet someone we know you like? They wouldn't tell me the name. And I said, no, I'm busy. I can't come. And then they rung me back and said, it's Cassius Clay, actually, who was then. It's Cassius Clay. I said, I'll be there. What time do you need me? And I went on. The program was about nerves. Because they said he never had any, and they said I didn't. And what turned out was a talk, and then a dartboard up on the wall, and I threw a through few, then showed him how to play, took his coat up, he said, I want to play the champ. And it went on for 15 minutes on TV, which is... And then I met him again in Utah, in America, where we had a barbecue together with other people. It was for the Boys Clubs of America charity. I was playing golf, that's how it happened. And we sat. He couldn't speak then, actually. But he just sat there, though, signing tracts, which you might be interested in, religious tracts. He sat there signing them. The tract was called, Is Jesus Really God? I'll never forget that. But he signed perfect. Yeah, although he got Parkinson's and shaking, he could still write absolutely perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, he was an incredible man. He really was. And I was going to ask about meeting people like this. I was just thinking about what you said about nerves as well, John. You know, this, you said, they said I didn't have any nerves. Was that true? Did you carry any nerves with you, or were you always as composed as you looked?
I think every sports person must have nerves. They must have. When they go in there and you're anxious. You've done everything right. You've practiced right. You've prepared right. But you still don't know what's going to happen. And the other day, if the other guy's better than you, you're on a losing end. Whereas Cassius Clay, he always seemed to be just that bit in front, didn't he?
Yeah, he was extraordinary, and he carried himself in an extraordinary way as well, didn't he? John, in terms of darts now, I mean, it is just humongous, isn't it? It's carried by major TV channels, and people turn out in huge numbers, and the prize money is extraordinary. I was probably asking the question is, do you think that John Lower is best would sit nicely in that congregation?
Yes. And the reason I say yes, if you look at the dartboard now, when I did the 9-dart game, the dartboard had big round wires and probably 100 scaffolds were held the wires to the board. So every time you threw, you never finished a game of 501 without one innocent wire and dropping on the floor. So to do a perfect game made it literally impossible. And now, no staples, razor blade wires, all the target areas are 14% bigger. And that's why you see the game higher, which is a good thing, because the better it looks, it gets more people to play.
Yeah.
And I think, given the modern day dartboard, yeah, I would have been fine with it.
Yeah. And as the kind of, for yourself, you know, that time when it arrives where you're not being in as many finals as perhaps you'd like, what was happening to you? Were you kind of just, you know, what happens to a darts player at the end of the very peak? I mean, I know you've had a wonderful career and you continued to play, but what was the difference between performing week in, week out to just stepping down a little bit?
Well, the reason I stepped out, because it was every weekend, literally, it got so big, there was no time off whatsoever. And I thought, well, I've done it long enough. So probably 23 years ago, I think it is, that I decided to quit the circuit and just do appearances, exhibitions, and should I say, take the easy part of the game. It's not easy because they still expect you to turn up and play really well. Unfortunately, I can't. This week, Friday, I'm at Banbury, doing a big one in Banbury. And so now I probably only do, on average, 2 a month. But that's quite nice. And people remember you. They don't always want me to play. They just want to turn up, speak, have a chat.
Yeah.
And similar to what we're doing now, go back on the past, you know. Takes a long time. Takes 50 years at least to have something to talk about for a long time.
Yeah. That must be lovely for you, though, to be held in that regard by the darts community. You know, you really are, you know, I mean, that word legend does get thrown about, but, you know, people of my generation and people of this generation, you know, pick out a name from darts and your name's going to be there, isn't it?
Which I'm thankful to, yeah. And it's not that I planned it. It's what happens in life, isn't it? That happened to be what's happened to me, you know, and other people actually gone out of the game because they can't play anymore. Some have carried on, the money now is incredible, so that if they do well for about 5 years, they can actually afford not to play again.
Yeah, yeah. And which darts players do you kind of admire, you know, maybe over the, you know, since your heyday, which are the players that stand out? You know, obviously, Phil Taylor is, you know, I was fortunate enough to meet Phil once upon a time and, you know, seemed to be a really lovely guy. He ruled the roost for many years, didn't he?
He did. Phil, 16 times world champion. That'll never be beat because now the competition's so fierce. The ones just below are coming through all the time, which is better for the game. It's far better than, it's like having a football team that can't lose. It's not good for the sport. You need other teams to and other individuals to come in, which they are doing. The young lads are coming through and they're playing very well. And they're a different breed. They're fitter as well. They look fitter, you know.
Yeah. Do you think some players, you know, do you think some players have lost the game before they've even thrown a dart when they're playing somebody like Phil Taylor, you know, or yourself back in the day, you know, are they intimidated by the individual?
They are. And you'd call it gamesmanship, really. But I once stood on a stage with 17,000 people there at Ali Pali, the old Alexander Palace. And the guy that came up, I said to him, there's a lot of people in here, aren't they? And he turned around and looked at the people. That's a bit of a gamesmanship, really. And of course, as soon as he saw the people, he'd gone. Literally. It was uncomfortable. Yeah. But the nice thing with darts is the people are behind you.
Yeah.
There's no one in front of you. You can't see the millions watching at home. You just see the dartboard.
One of the things, you know, I used to work for Argos, John. I used to be a manager, and one of the things that felt like I had to have in abundance was resilience, and I suppose that applies to the greatest sports people as well. Can you say a bit about resilience, and maybe within that, can you recall maybe your greatest comeback, you know, where you were kind of back against the wall, looking down the barrel of a gun, and you dug so deep and turned it round?
I can, and it's happened many times around the world, in New Zealand, on the South Island, in the World Cup against Jockey Wilson in the singles. And Jockey was playing absolutely brilliant. And I thought, what do I do here? You know, you do think, what can I do? What can I change? And so you change. There's little things in darts where you move your two fingers, your thumb and your index finger back, and it actually makes the dart go down and up, which is a bit technical, really. And I tried little things like that, overcome him, got one in front and one of the singles. And so it was like, don't give in. You know, you've not lost until the Palisades game over.
Have you been on the opposite of that, John, where you've had a commanding lead and then, you know, somebody's come, got a gust of wind and just came sailing past you, and you thought, sometimes it's just unstoppable, isn't it?
It is, and Eric did that to me in the time when I was 3 sets to nil up, and it was only best, the first of 5-1, the World Championship, and he come back and reeled 4 sets off in a row. I did blame that I wasn't quite well, but I didn't. Afterwards, shook hands with him and said, great throw. You know, you've got to accept your losses as well as the wins, and I'm fortunate enough to probably have more wins than losses.
Yeah. John, do you get annoyed when people maybe underestimate a darts player or the sport? You know, I guess, you know, kind of, you know, there's been talk over the years about it being an Olympic sport, and there's also the question whether it's a pub game or whether it's a sport. I mean, I know what I think, but what's your own interpretation of that?
I just think people got their own opinion, and usually the ones that say that are not watching it anyways. They're not really fans of it. They don't like it. So they just come to say, well, no, it's just a pub game. You know, and now things have changed. Just, there's not many dartboards in pubs anymore, believe it or not. It's now gone into leisure centres. The one at Wigan, there's one at Wigan there where they have the tournaments twice a month, which is the PDC, the Professional Darts Council. So it's changed. It's changed. The youngsters now are coming through academies. That never happened before. You know, and the academies, when they say the pub, there isn't even a bar in there. So in many ways, it's changing. It's and it's in good health. That's the nice thing. They've got a plan that's laid out for the next 20 years. And sponsors are just falling over to come in. You know, it still reaches the ordinary person.
Yeah.
The ones above.
And what's your view on sports psychology, John? I guess in your day, there wasn't an awful lot of it about, you know, or am I wrong? Was there, you know, but now, you know, there's so much analysis and, you know, kind of psychological involvement and experts getting involved. What's your experience of that?
I think it's right, but the doubts are the experts experts? That's the thing that gets me. I mean, I play golf. That's my passion. And I've seen the ones there, I know a lot of the top players, and they all have psychologists help them. And they turn up on the day just to look after two players. And it does help. And they're not just telling them they're holding the club wrong. It's all to do with breathing and things like that. And that does overcome nerves. I mean, if you breathe properly, that'll overcome nerves quite a lot. But some people are destined, they'll never overcome it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, again, my management career, quite often retailers were bringing sports legends to talk about the psychology. I remember Adrian Morehouse, you remember the swimmer who won his gold medal by the smallest of margins and talked about that. Do you think if you'd have had that benefit of sports psychology when you were playing in those finals, that could have possibly made a difference, you know, when you reflect back?
Looking back on it, I'm not sure. Because, as you said, we didn't have people like that at all. Chris Akabuchi, he goes around, that's all he does, goes around talking to people in business of psychology through sport. It's the same thing. And whether darts will come to that at the moment, I don't know. But there are coaches now, and they have to coach the game. And there is a way, there's a way to teach that makes you play a lot better. Which I
believe, it's been really lovely chatting to you, John. Can I ask you about the MBE? Because that's kind of like, that's the cherry on the cake, isn't it? That's the greatest honour to bestowed upon you for your service to a sport that you've kind of dedicated, you know, not all of it, but you know, a very large portion of your life to. Just tell us how that came about, and were you surprised? And I know it was Prince William that awarded. Just tell us a bit about that. experience, John, please.
Well, it is an experience, a great experience. And I must be honest, you have to be nominated. You can't do it yourself. But you have to be nominated to get an MBE by the people who think it's right that you should have one. And my particular person was Mike Watterson. I don't know if you remember Mike. He actually formed the first professional snooker players tournament at the Crucible, but he also formed the very first darts tournament in Nottingham. And we're friends. He's from Chesterfield. He took over from the old Fred Davis. And it was Mike who nominated me. And then you need nominees on top of that. And I was fortunate the Duke of Devonshire came in because I'd worked with him with charity. And then Barry Earn came in from sport. And a lot. MPs, Toby Perkins, the MP, my local MP, came in. And it makes a lot of difference to have the right ones. And then when it came through that I'd won the, well, one sounds wrong, but been given the MBE, and I was to go to Buckingham Palace for that's probably the best moment of my whole life. I drove my car through the gates of Buckingham Palace, and I thought that was unreal. And yeah. Prince William, you line up, and it's like you're allowed about a minute and a half talk. And just as he come to the end to shake hands, I said, "And best wishes, I'm passing best wishes from a good friend of yours." And he said, "Who's that?" I said, "Graham Cracker." He said, "Cracker?" I said, "Oh, yeah, well, he was Prince Edward's bodyguard for him and Harry when his mother died and the reef came off the car. He was the guy who got out and picked the reef up."
Really?
And I've known Graham for years and years through Macmillan Nurses. That's the charity I work with him. And he said to me, the talk between us then went on for about 3 minutes. And he did say to me, "I hope you'll accept this award on behalf of darts and not your charity." And that was Prince William. And I said, "I will, thank you." And I've stuck with that because I tend to say, "Listen, I've enjoyed doing charity work." But now I don't so much say that. I just say, "No, it was given for darts." And that was from Prince William, really.
Oh, what a wonderful thing, John, eh?
Yeah, it's great.
I bet that 22-year-old joiner never thought, "Gosh, I'm gonna drive my car through the gates of Buckingham Palace."
Well, that 22-year-old joiner's father was a miner, and he never even went to London. The farthest ever went to a Blackpool. There'd never been any farther. So in a way, that would have been great for the parents if they'd have still been around.
Yeah. Yeah. And now you are kind of, well, you're still doing, like you say, a couple of sessions a month, but you enjoy the golf, and I guess you played on some of the most beautiful courses.
I have, again, through invites and maybe through darts. It's surprising who's played darts in different places. You know, I've played in the government building in Japan, which I've played like the paraplegics, where there'd be 16 dartboards, 16 in either wheelchairs or amputees, and throw like the chess players did, one move at a time. And I'd throw the first ball, then go for the next. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
It's things like that. Then golf, I've been invited to many golf courses, play with most of the top players. The only one I didn't play with was Seve Ballesteros, who was, again, my hero.
Yeah. Mine too. He was a cat. Oh, I'd love to have met. So, did you actually meet him though? Did you ever get to meet him?
I did. I know his caddy, Peter Wright, was his caddy at that time. And at Lytham, I met him. He won twice at Lytham, and I was there both times. And he was a fantastic player. And he did a lot for the sport, especially in Spain.
Yeah. And have you managed to get to any of the Ryder Cups to spectate?
I've been to five.
Right, okay.
At the Belfry, I went to three at the Belfry. All thank you to Carlsberg Brewery. They invited me as their to meet their guests at night time.
Yeah.
But it was lovely. Yeah, enjoyed it.
Fabulous. And what about the old guys, the old boys from the circuit? John, do you still keep in touch with any of them? And if so, who?
I was with Keith Geller 2 weeks ago at Chepstow. And a few of them we meet up now and again. Sadly, some of them have gone. Late Reese not with us anymore. Alan Evans, Jockey Wilson. They've sadly all gone. Cliff Lazarenko's retired. But we still meet up. Bob Anderson, I meet now and again, you know. And what I do mainly is most of the nights I'm on my own, you know, like, because as I say now, the sport's so big and the cost so heavy, they've got to cover the cost for it for the book.
Yeah, yeah. And so, yeah, just was Keith Della lucky then? Because you said about, you know, one is lucky. Is Keith Della lucky?
You jumped on that one, and you were right. A lot of people say that to him. I don't say that to him, because to win that title, it'd be me, Jockey, and Derek in the quarterfinal, semi-final, and final. Mm. And we were 1, 2, and 3 in the world. And he was a qualifier. He wasn't even ranked. So, in a way, he proved how good he was.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
Yeah. John, I'm really great. I've really enjoyed chatting to you. It's been a nostalgic trip down memory lane. I know that there'll be loads of people in the darts community who will be chuffed to bits to see you looking well and enjoying life. And where are you next? Is it Banbury, did you say?
Banbury, yeah. It's a new place. What's just called Danny's. It's called Danny's. It's a grill. It's a grill and a sports complex right in the middle of Banbury, a very big one.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, you're in Chesterfield. I've got nothing but bad memories about Chesterfield. I came to watch Burnley in Chesterfield in the old days when we were struggling and my car broke down and I ended up having to get the train back and towed home the day after. But
That'd be at the old Salter Gate.
Yeah, that's right.
Stadium, and we beat Portsmouth in the FA Cup last Saturday.
Yeah. Well, you've got an ex-Burnley player there as your gap. Paul Cook is your manager, isn't he?
We have, and we actually on guide here for us and managed us. And I know you were all sad when he left Burnley, weren't you?
Yeah. Yeah, he's held in the highest regard. I think the guy deserves a statue at Turf Moor for what he did for our club. It's incredible.
You'll probably get one at Everton.
Well, yeah, maybe, yeah. Yeah. Well, John, thanks so much. And if you've enjoyed listening to this chat with John, there's lots of other sportsmen on the Godcast, and just go check it out. But John, I just want to thank you very much for coming on. Thank you.
Thank you. And before you go, just do me a favour, will you? Just say hello to Mark and Jenny, the girl who swears a lot.
Oh, you've read the book, have you?
I've read the book, yes.
John, that's very
it's a great
kind.
Book. I enjoyed it, and I read it all in 4 hours.
Did you?
I couldn't put it down. It was great.
Really? Oh, John, that's really touched me. Thank you for reading the book. And I will pass on my love to Mark, and Jenny swears a lot.
If you would, and the reason is, I think I know about a million people that are like that.
Yeah. It's very true, John. There's a lot of people going through a lot of struggles at the moment.
Yeah, there is.
And, you know, I just try and be a voice for them. And you just saying that gives them a voice as well, because they do need one. You know, life's not easy for many people. So I really, really appreciate it. Thank you, John. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
God bless you.
And you.